session number 23812, Reel 2.
Mr. Doy, Reel 2. Now, I believe you've got a story reverting back to your school days, which I think would be interesting for people to hear.
I think it will be interesting because I now refer to a worldwide figure, namely George Orwell, who, of course, was really Eric Blair. But as you know, Animal Farm was one of his great books, Animal Farm. Well, I can recall as a boy, around about 10 years old in the early 1930s, and I was with a friend who still resides in Southall, in Station Road, Keith Taylor. And Keith's father was one of the tradesmen of the day, inasmuch as painting and decorating was concerned. Keith and I, and the schoolboys of that day, used Southwold Common as our playground. And the bushes over there, the gorse bushes, that is, we would frequent the gorse bushes, and we would create what we called in those days dens. And we had secret pathways going through the gorse bushes, and we would enter these dens, and as boys we used to try smoke as many cigarettes as we could, namely woodbines, which was 5 in the packet, and we used to share these 5 woodbines, we having 2.5 each, and we would measure the one cigarette, so we got exactly half, and we would sit there smoking. Well, it was whilst enjoying a summer's day over there at on Southall Common, a place called the Wynn Hill, which was spelt W-H-I-N, that we witnessed two people digging on the top of Wynn Hill, the mound on top of Wynn Hill, and they were digging away, and we spied on them through the gorse bushes. One was Dennis Collins, whose father was the local doctor of the day and who lived on North Parade, well-known local doctor. And the other was Eric Blair, who later became known as George Orwell. And they were digging, they were both archaeologists, as it turned out, as I learned in later life. And we saw them digging away, and quite obviously they were digging on the assumption that under the mole, the mound on the Wynn Hill, they would find some interesting artefacts going back many, many years. But they didn't find anything as far as we were aware. But what I can recall, which I think should be documented somehow in Southwold, that Keith Taylor and myself were the only witnesses to know that in that mound that George Orwell or Eric Blair and Dennis Collins, they secreted many artefacts of the day. In fact, I can remember them putting such things as the First World War artefacts, like a steel helmet and that, in there. And so they're now hidden in that Wynn Hill, and a world-famous figure whom we witness, we do know, and I, as I've said, I think it should be documented that there is, for somebody in the future, probably many years hence, will dig up and they will find these artefacts. So it is something which related to our younger days and Eric Blair or George Orwell.
Why would they put those artefacts in there? I mean, that's not archaeology, putting things in.
They, no doubt, what would you call it, a time capsule nowadays? Yeah, that's what it would be, wouldn't it? And so therefore, perhaps there's a bit of local history, what we know, which others don't.
Now, what did you have any air raid precautions in Southwold? I know you left in May. Between January and May, had you got shelters, Andersons or anything?
There were, of course, these Anderson shelters, I think, in those days. I couldn't be absolutely clear in my mind that they existed. that I think most people, because it was an unknown factor as to what bombing really meant, and I can recall when, as I said, I was a scout, and the air raid warning went, and I found my younger brother under the table with some of my other brothers and sisters, which, of course, as we learned long afterwards, that a bomb on the table wouldn't have helped them much. But there was also sandbags around the local town hall, etc., and other places had sandbags, which were, I suppose, to prevent the blast from damaging the buildings. But they, like ourselves, I don't think had any conception really of what bombing really meant.
What about the blackout?
The blackout, yes, there was a blackout, of course, in those days. And I remember seeing, I think that was a Dormer Pencil, a German aircraft coming over. And it had one of these mines, an air mine, which came down by parachute. And I think they were aiming at Southwold Harbour entrance. But that mine actually landed where, very close to where the caravan site is nowadays at Southwold Harbour. And I think one can see where it created quite a hole in the ground. And I believe if you go up there today, you will find that by looking just before you come to the caravan site, that there is this indention in the ground there, which is now, of course, covered over with grass, etc.
Were there any bombing raids or bombs dropped?
There was also a ship called the Royal Crown, which was bombed, and it went aground at Eastern Bavance. And I can well recall going up there to see this ship, and whilst we were there looking at this ship, which was aground, there were some enemy aircraft come along the cliff tops, about just above the cliff tops, and any minute now we expected it to be machine gun, but they didn't open fire on us. On Southwold Beach, round about that particular time, because there were these ships being sunk outside the town, I can well recall large bales of wool coming ashore. When I say that was wool raw, in a raw state, probably from the sheep's fleece, and they landed many of these bales on Southwold Beach and along the coast adjoining Southwold. There was also quite an amount of coal which was washed up on Southwold Beach, and of course the residents of the day were down there with their buckets, etc., etc., collecting coal, because after all, there was going to be rations and that sort of thing, and that stood many people in good stead. The beach.
Well, did I ask, did you have any beach defences? You know,
yes, there were.
Before you left, I mean.
There were beach defences being put up before I left.
What were they like?
Well, there were spikes put into the the beaches and concrete blocks. There was also these mines, these sort of little landmines, which were buried under the coast. And there were one or two of the local residents who, unfortunately, were maimed, and one or two were killed on Southwold Beach by going onto the beach when they shouldn't have done, I suppose, really. I really don't know too much about that because, as I say, I was young at the time. But that I believe that there were obviously, after I was called up, there were of course, many happenings as far as defence was concerned.
Now, anything else you remember before you left?
before I left.
Or called up, rather. Yeah.
I can't recall much much happening, really. There were these different things. I can say that that war was in its infancy then.
Had rationing kicked in?
Rationing, I don't know necessarily if there were rationing. I can't really recall it, but I could well imagine that was probably being brought in. Yeah.
Right, what about your call-up? What was the procedure for your call-up? I mean, how did they go about calling you up?
Well, first of all, being very fond of the sea, of which I used to do a lot of fishing. When I say fishing, I'd go out in the boat if I could. I also used to go with my friends. This was in our younger days, and we'd go on Southwold Pier. And we would go to the end of the pier on what we called the T end. That was where the bell steamers of the day used to come in. And we would fish all night long in the depth of winter, we boys, and we would catch quite a lot of fish. In fact, one of the things, being boys, I suppose, we would smoke if we could. We'd also drink if we could. And at the pub in Srebbick Road, which today is quite well known there, the Lighthouse, at the side of that pub, there was what was called in those days a snug. It was a very small entrance which was always kept dark. And the reason it was kept dark, because it was shameful for any lady to go into a public house in those days. And so the old men of the day, the old fishermen, would send their wives out with in their carpet slippers so they couldn't be heard in the dark. And they would have a jug in their hands and they'd go into the snug. And the landlord of the day would then... They would hand the jug over. They'd know exactly what to give that person of filling that jug up with Southwold ale. And the lady would go out without being seen rather furtively. Well, we boys took advantage of this before we went fishing. And we would go into the dark, and we would try and talk as best as we could in a gruff voice what we could. We would get these little small bottles of White Horse whiskey. Whether the landlord really knew who we were anyway, we simply laid the money on the counter and he'd put the bottle there, and we would take these bottles on Southwold Pier at the end, and we would drink the whiskey during the course of the night, which in those days, I suppose, was boys being boys. Well, that's the sort of thing we did. And of course, I was in the local choir at the time, Southwold Church. And
the reason you mentioned the fishing was because I think you were going to say that you were wanting to get into the Navy.
Oh, sorry.
I think that's where you were going.
Yes, that's right. Yes, we get carried away with our more youthful days, don't we? So being associated, and also my mother's side of the family were all people to do with the sea. My father's to do with the land, my mother's brothers, etc., and family and father were to do with the sea. And my old grandfather, that's my mother's grandfather, was one of the old skippers of the trawlers, the steam trawlers in those days. They were steam trawlers. And because of his association and that side of it, that caught my imagination. And my uncles and that were in the First World War and were, of course, in the Navy. And one of my uncles had received a very high award for his bravery. So I elected to join the Navy if I could. But when I tried to join the Navy, I was turned down.
Do you know why?
Yeah, because they were absolutely chock-a-block with applications to join the Navy, and most unfortunately I was turned down because of that fact. This then meant that I received a notification from Norwich, the Martini Hall in Norwich, to attend there for a medical examination.
Now, what do you remember of that medical? Because we're interested in how serious they were and what they actually did at the medical, if you remember it.
Yes, I can recall going to Norwich. We were sent a travelling warrant, and I arrived at Norwich and went to this place which was called Martini Hall. And whilst we were in there, it was basically we were told to strip off, and so we were lined up, and there was a medical officer, and he would test the chest, he'd knock on this, and write down what he considered was your state of health on some form or other. I suppose that obviously was the case, and I can well record that we had to give a sample of our water, and many of the chaps couldn't give a sample because they they couldn't make water, so they used to turn taps on, running water, which would induce you to pee in the bottle, so to speak, and that was that. Well, anyway, that was the way it was done. It was soon over.
Was there any kind of intelligence test? You know,
There was no intelligence test of the day. Not as far as I was concerned. We may have been asked various questions. Obviously, there was somebody sitting there asking your name and all that sort of thing, details of where you worked, your occupation, etc., etc. I was past A1, and then eventually I received a notification that I was to join the Royal Norfolk Regiment at the Britannia Barracks in Norwich.
Now, had you any choice at all about that?
One did have no choice whatsoever. There was no choice whatsoever. You were told what to do right from the start, and that was it.
And that was in May 1940.
That was right.
And you were a civilian, and what happened? How did they take you in? You know, when you turned up at the barracks, how did they take you in and sort of issue your kit, welcome, if that's the right word, and start making you a soldier?
Well, I arrived with others, with an attache case, at Britannia Barracks, and we were met by a sergeant, who then took us to what was to be our quarters. We were then told to leave our suitcases at this particular point in this building of which we were to be housed, in this particular barrack. And we were then taken off once again to fill in forms, etc., etc., to be asked various questions, to have a medical examination once again. And when we returned, because the sergeant in question and others at the Britannia Barracks were the old soldiers, as we learnt, and being very naive and being totally honest and coming from places like Southall and our upbringing, etc., etc., we didn't expect to find that when we got back that our suitcases had been rifled and various little things were taken and stolen by some of these so-called regular soldiers of the day. We were, in fact, greenhorns. It didn't take us long to become the reverse, I can assure you on that. We were then issued with palliasses. Now, palliasses, in case people don't realise what they are, is a type of mattress, an empty mattress, stuffed with straw. And this was to be our bedding.
Did you have to stuff them yourselves, or were they ready to...
I think that they were already there, yeah, as far as I can recall. So those were what we laid on. We were then, the very next day, we were paraded out onto the barracks square where the drill master, and there was the whoever he was, the general or colonel or whatever he was in charge of the barracks. He then gave us a talk, and he said to us, I can recall his words as saying, you are here to fight for your king and country. Within 2 or 3 weeks, you will be across the water to France to face the Boche. And you will be hardened off, and you will be made into soldiers in next to no time. So anyway, we listened to this speech with a certain amount of apprehension, obviously. We were then marched off to a big building, and we queued up without any idea what was going to happen. But as we got further forward towards the door and the entrance to this building, we saw some chaps being carried out, which once again filled us with a certain amount of apprehension. When we got in, there were these medical officers, and probably medical orderlies, I couldn't say, with these hypodermic syringes, and they were going to inject these into our arms and vaccinate those and one thing or another. And hence the reason why chaps were passing out. And in those days, they were not the type of hypodermic syringe that you would have nowadays. It's fine here that that seemed to be all taken from the same one, and as they progressed, so the needle got blunter and blunter. But nevertheless, that was my first experience of that type of thing.
Did it cause a reaction?
It did. On some people, it caused quite a reaction, yes, and some people were quite ill.
What about you?
As far as I myself, I took it all right. Yeah, I was all right.
Now, what about kitting out? We haven't got that.
Yes, we were then kitted out with, in those days, what was called denim. I think it was spelt D-E-N-I-M, denim uniforms. They were very badly fixed to us. I can remember I looked more like a tortoise because the neck of mine hang down halfway down the chest. But nevertheless, we were fitted out with whatever they could find in those days. And it was not long before we were learnt to go on to the barrack square.
Hang on, did you get any other kit, or was it just...
Yes, we had a kit bag with various things, utensils, etc. The basic things that were required, such as a soup and flannel, shaving material, and the like.
Just the one denim uniform?
One denim uniform. Before we received our khaki uniforms, that was what we were issued with.
If we sort of look at the conditions in a typical day, let's start with, what was your barrack like? Was it part of the old barrack? You know it's up on the hill, isn't it?
Yeah.
Part of that, or was it in the huts behind it, or had they built that?
No, it was part of the old brick barracks, Britannia barracks, which I was housed, yeah.
What was the room like? Can you describe it?
It was a type of dormitory, I suppose, very austere in its decor. We laid on the floor, as I've said, in rows, and we were greeted in the morning with a bugler who had us out of bed at the early hours, of which we then had to get up and go to the ablutions to wash, shave, etc., etc. We were given a lot of time in which to do that. This was followed by going into a large building where we received our breakfast.
Now, what were your first impressions of army food then?
Our first impressions of army food, etc., etc., was not too bad, really. I suppose the food that we received was was the type of thing that you would have on normal days at home before the war. You would have eggs, bacon, etc. There would be bread, doorstep bread, of course, cut about half an inch thick. There was that type of thing, but I don't suppose we could really complain about the food as such that we were
looking,
receiving.
Looking on, what would you get for lunch and tea?
Lunch and tea.
Just to keep the food together.
Lunch and tea, we would have a mug of tea, of course. There would be the normal things that one would expect to have, potatoes, and greens, etc., etc. The general English type of food that one would look upon now as being English and not the foreign stuff that we most people have nowadays. So I don't think that we could really complain.
Was it decent quality meat, you know?
Yes, I think it was as far as one could recall in those far-off days. Certainly we were not starved.
There was enough of it. Cause
I think we were. But that's a little bit dim in, as far as my memory is concerned.
Now, after breakfast, let's go back to breakfast then. After breakfast, what would your training be?
Our training was drill.
Now, tell me about drill. How did you take to it?
Well, drill, there was a drill sergeant. And we would be taught to march in the correct manner. Left, right, that sort of thing. About turn and all those sort of general instructions which even exist nowadays in the armies. And so they really put us through it. I suppose that probably the worst thing what happened every day was not necessarily the drill, but was the physical exercise, of which we had a brute of a chap there who threatened to kick our teeth in and all that sort of thing,
you know his name?
In those days. In other words, we realised afterwards that this was to try and get us away from our easy life and get us physically fit to, as the Commander-in-Chief had said, that we would be in France. And I can remember it nearly killed us. And on these...
What were you doing at PT?
One of the things that we had to do was to go on the adjoining Mousehold Heath at Norwich. And we had to run there. We were not allowed in any way to walk. We had to run and as fast as we could all round the heath and back. And then immediately we ran, despite the fact that we were absolutely drenched in perspiration. We had to run under a cold shower, which completely took one's breath away. And the fact I thought, well, you know, it was something which I would like to go through again. But I suppose it really did toughen us up. And like the rest of us, I can remember that homesickness quite obviously crept in. And
how did you feel? Because I wanted to ask you about homesickness, because you really were a South Wales boy. You hadn't really experienced it. How did it strike you?
Well, we had been brought up under the umbrella of decent parents and that sort of thing, even in large families. And to leave and to go into the extremes of what we were put through, really bashed us about, and it was one of the things which we could say was an absolute torture for us who really suffered with homesickness. But I will say this, that it was something which soon wore off, because one met other chaps, obviously we were all in the same boat.